You know, if you're driving, you might run across the one-way sign occasionally, and if you do, you know what that means, that it's really dangerous to go against that green of traffic flow. It's risky. Now, this sign is a little different than those. This doesn't say one way. It says only way. Like, wherever you're headed, this is it. There's no other choice, and if there's really no other choice, what's the reason for the sign, I suppose? The cynical among us might think that. But you don't find these very often, but we could relate to this when we think about the gospel. We think about the gospel with this vantage point. You know, Jesus is the way, the only way to enter into a right relationship with a Father. In fact, people don't really object to us declaring that we believe that Jesus is the way. What we do find resistance to is that intolerant, some would say arrogant, that approach that says he is it, there's no other way. Why is it that Christians have to get so strong on this one statement? I mean, sure, that's good for you, but really, is that the way we have to approach this, that Jesus is it, that's the only way? And then when that question comes up, we would dutifully say, oh, but what about John 14:6? I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. That was Jesus' conversation with his disciples. And if we're trying to make the point, we would say, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes. We'd emphasize that, and people might not even respond to that. And I'm not saying for a moment that that shouldn't be in our wheelhouse. That ought to come out pretty quickly that way. In fact, even Peter wrote, let each of us be ready with an answer for someone who lies or asks of the hope that lies within us. And then he adds those qualifiers with grace and respect. With graciousness and respect that way, gentleness. My premise today is not that Jesus is the only way. I'm sure you would agree with that, but I'm going to also say that there could not be any other possible way for us to have the redemption that we do if it weren't for Christ. It's not just that he is the way. There is no other way. Reconciliation could happen that way. And I would dare say that with the simple hand illustration, we're going to lay out five reasons why we find this to be the case in Romans 3. You can turn to Romans 3 in your Bible, and we'll take a look at some of this. Now, I feel somewhat awkward because Romans 1 and 2 and the first part of 3 were there for a context, an understanding, and we're cutting into that. And part of that is I know some of the information in those chapters is assumed true. You understand it. You've been part of a church where this has been taught in different ABF settings and in small group studies, even though I realize that there may be some here that haven't been part of that, some definitely on our internet site that are listening and won't have all of that context. I'm not trying to shortchange it at all, but I want to maybe hit these points, and we're going to take a look at Romans 3 and see this connection between God's hand of justice and redemption. As we start that way, the first point that I want to make has to do with this. It's found in verse 9, and it simply says that Jews and Gentiles are all under sin. Here's what it says. What then? Are we Jews any better off? No, not at all, Paul writes. For we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin. He sets that up and says it doesn't matter. Some people were thinking, well, because we're God's chosen people, we've got an inside track with God. And his case is, no, that is not true. That is not true. We're no better off. Jews and Greeks, Jews and Gentiles, Jews and non-Jews. He's making this Pretty strong statement. We're all under it. Have you ever felt like you're weighed down under circumstances? It could be job related. You know, you go in with a to-do list that you planned on getting done, and you start digging hard to make sure you've got the work done. If it is in any line of work, that you have those days, those moments where something needs to happen, you got your work in front of you, but somebody comes along with something that just has to be done. And before you can get that one done, somebody else has something else happen. It's like the conveyor belt on an assembly line that never stops. Even if you have a difficulty there, it's going to keep piling stuff up there. And by the end of the day, you're working so hard and you've got more to do than you started at the beginning of the day. And some of you could say, well, I don't know if I've got that kind of work experience. But have you ever been there financially? Where you're trying to get your nose above the waterline on just the cash flow problem. You're digging hard to make that happen, and then you're taking in a little air, you see a little bit, and then boom, what happens? The car. Something goes wrong with the vehicle. Oh, it's the water heater. We got to have that. Oh, the furnace went down. I'm not talking little things, but the kind of things that really compare you, and you feel like, am I ever going to get out from under this? Well, this is the kind of imagery that's there. We're under sin. We're all under sin. That is true for the Greeks or the non-Jews. It's true for the Jews as well. And then, look, you just follow along in verses 10, 11, 12. I'm going to read from Psalm 14 while you look along. Watch these phrases roll off of Psalm 14 that show up in Paul's thinking here. He was a Pharisee that understood the Old Testament well, and it's almost paralleled in Psalm 53. But here's what it says. You look in 10, 11, and 12 of Romans 3, and I'm going to read the other section here. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There is none who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven on the children of man to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. They have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is none who does good, not even one. This cuts across ethnic and cultural boundaries. Now, Paul says it right there. We're all under it. It cuts across the generational divide that we have. It doesn't matter whether you're a baby boomer, a Gen Xer, a millennial, or part of the greatest generation. Everybody's impacted the same way. It doesn't matter where you are in your relational status. It's true for those that are single. Equally true for those that are married. Equally true for those that are separated. It's true for those who are divorced. It's true for those who are widowed. You get the idea? It's true for the poorest peasants of Mongolia or the richest sultans of Saudi Arabia or that top tier that lives in Manhattan, New York. It doesn't matter where you are on the scale. It doesn't matter where you are in your family setup. It doesn't matter where you are in your ethnicity. We're all under sin. That is so clear from Scripture. That is critical to watching this unfold and this understanding God's justice and His redemption that way. Under sin. That is breaking God's will, His law, His desires for us. He created the world. He's the owner. He's the one that gets to dictate what it is. And the reason why I say that is there a book came out way back in the 90s. And I remember everybody talking about it then. And I went to get it at the library when I lived in Pennsylvania. I've checked it out from Macmillan here, and it was a book entitled The Day America Told the Truth, back in the 90s. One of the statements in that book said that only 17% define sin as a violation of God's desired will. That means 83 out of 100 people missed the concept. Oh, they thought sin was doing something wrong, but it was never tied to the fact that God was the one who declared something was right or wrong. They had a much more subjective view of what that is. Now, let's just stop for a second and let me ask you this. If you could pick out what was sinful and what was not, wouldn't you be tempted a little bit to just slide on the things that you're most prone to do? Sure, I would be too. Let's take that one off the list so I don't have to consider that one a sin. The ones I'm prone to do all the time, they're now dismissed from. It doesn't work that way. No, God's the one that did that. He set up the guidelines that way. It brings us to a second point that I would like us to consider. The law is God's gracious provision. And I know what happens. People hear God's law, and there goes the switch. We're shutting down. Don't want to think about it. No, that's negative. It's frustrating. God says that, but I don't live that way. I don't want to think about the law. But it's God's gracious provision. Here's what it says in verse 19. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law. Well, we're under sin. We're under the law. The law speaks to those of us who are there. Why is it gracious for God to tell us what his standard is? Because there's no questioning where the line is. What is the standard? It's not up to you and me. There is an objective standard that's there. That's a gracious provision. Think about it this way. A number of years ago, I was driving in Carbondale, Pennsylvania. Now, any of you that even know that town because you've talked to people or whatever from that northeast Pennsylvania area and Clark Summit and whatever, understand that little highway that takes you out from Clark Summit area. And I was there in a really dynamic vehicle. I mean, this thing was a performance-based machine. It was an 85 Plymouth Voyager. This is important to the story. Four small cylinders, for the record. I had three boys, a wife, and her parents in the car, in the van. And I'm coming through there, and I look up, and lo and behold, there is a police officer with his lights on. So I dutifully pull over so he could pass and go catch the bad guy. And he pulls in behind me. Now, my kids had never been that close to anything that exciting in their life, even with Uncle Jim that's a police officer, because they got to see the lights on. And, of course, now the officer is coming to my window, and they think I'm heading to the big house. I'm going to be in jail, not the other big house that Michigan fans talk about. And he says to me, license and registration, I'm getting that out, and I'm thinking, what is going on? He said, do you have any idea how fast you're driving? And I said, 45? Well, we agree. And I'm confused. And he said, the speed limit was 25. And I point to the sign. I pulled the sign right there. Says 45. And I pointed, gestured to that. Said that sign says 45. Well, right here it is. But back there it was 25. And I said, where? I didn't see the signs. Well, I'm sorry, but it was posted. Oh, yes, we've been trying to get our city commission to get more signs up there. And I thought, oh, one of those. But anyway, I was given a speeding ticket. I hate speeding because it's the biggest waste of money I can ever think of. You get nothing for it. And what was it? I had violated the sign, and the fact that I didn't see the signs didn't mean that I was exempt from it. But the signs were there. Not enough. There was at least one and probably more. But I didn't see them. And I got the ticket. Let's adjust that a little bit. Let's say you're driving now. You're on a country road in central Wisconsin. And we're talking fields on both sides of you. You've got a convertible. And you're just enjoying the sunshine and the breeze blowing in your hair because it is beautiful. You're going 50 miles an hour. And you have the same experience, only the siren comes on, you pull over, and he says, you're speeding. Speed limit here is 30. What do you mean 30? There's no signs here. And are you? What? How could it be 30? And he said, just a minute. And he brings out the village council minutes. Yeah, it says right here, they're concerned about this stretch of road, and so they determined this was going to be 30 miles an hour. There's no cross streets, there's no buildings. Yeah, but the speed limit right here is 30, and you're doing 50. You're over the speed limit. Where are the signs? Well, you know, we don't use the signs because they're kind of legalistic. And you know what? They kind of detract. They aren't attractive to have those here. It interrupts the scenery. So we didn't buy. And then they cost a lot of money to post those. And so, but see, I'm not from around here. Well, that's obvious. So we just wait for people like you to come in, and then we get you for speeding. And you would be just livid saying, that is not right, that's not fair. There's no way in the world I should be held accountable for something that I have no knowledge about. And you would be right. So when I say that God gave us his law, and it's an act of graciousness on his part, do you see why? The standard is set. And then, I don't have to guess with that in any way, shape, or form. I know exactly what it is. What's next? We've got the law. We've broken it, and there are consequences for it. Now, we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law. Let's keep reading. So that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. Verse 20 says this at the end. Since through the law comes knowledge of sin, every mouth will be stopped. The whole world is accountable to God. Every mouth may be silenced. Everybody makes mistakes. Is that such a big deal? In fact, let me see if you can fill in this statement. This is a common statement. To err is human, or err, if you've learned it that way. To err is human, to err is human, but to forgive, divine. To err is human, to forgive, divine. To make mistakes is just an everyday universal experience. It means you're human. But God, that divine element, is forgiving. So if it's so common for everybody to make the mistakes, then isn't it just as common for God to be forgiving? And I'd ask you this, does that hold true if you're talking to someone who's the victim of a violent crime? Well, he just had a bad day. He made a mistake. Everybody makes mistakes. Can't you forgive? And you'd say flat out, no. No, because sin requires justice. Sin requires something more. There's consequences there. If it's natural for us to blow it, it's natural for God to hold us accountable for that. Natural consequences for violating God's law is not forgiveness, but condemnation. Think with me for a moment. Some of you know the section in Isaiah 6. Isaiah was the prophet of God, a moral leader, an upright preacher. He was God's person. for Israel during that season of Israel's history. And what happens when he sees God in his holiness? He cowers back and says, I am ruined. I am undone. Now, this was the morally upright prophet. How did he go from moral upright proclaimer of God's message to saying, I am ruined, I'm sinful, because he saw God in his holiness? How about John, the disciple whom Jesus loved? Scripture records that even at the Last Supper, he's near Jesus at the table. He refers to himself over and over again as the disciple whom Jesus loved. And what does John give us when he sees, in the book of the Revelation, he records the vision. When he sees the Son of God, Christ, in that thing, he said, I fell down as though I were dead. You see, God's holiness just kind of assumes we're going to cower. We're going to have a difficult time with this. And we see God in his holiness, and it has this tremendous effect on us. It's almost like you take that fish out of water and put him in a different environment, and that fish slowly just cannot survive in that environment. The gills work for a time. The eyes kind of get cloudy. Not much movement. Can't survive. I wonder if that image doesn't represent what would be ours in God's presence without Christ. We're condemned. The next point on here, our ring finger. Verses 21 through 24, you'd find this. God's justice and Christ offer a time to pay up, but I'll pick up your debt. He is going to do something fantastic here. But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law. Oh, apart from the law. Although the law and the prophets bear witness to it. The righteousness of God through faith in Christ Jesus for all who believe. Wow. He's going to do something. And he states right here that it's going to be not because of the law, but apart from it. The standard will be met at such a level that you can just reference it. He didn't have to work at it. He fulfilled everything without question that way. That redemption that's offered is pictured often in the world of slavery, especially first century slavery, which was different than our American travesty that went on in our nation's history. There you had people from different ethnicities and different groups. They were a slave that it was done differently, but the same principle was there. For a slave to have their freedom, they would have to be redeemed somehow by another person or by their own savings to pay the slave owner for that freedom. Had to pick up a debt somehow. In our context, let's look at it this way. If you are behind on your mortgage and you're fighting and you can't keep up, and then someone comes in and says, how far are you behind? And I say, I'm already 4 months behind. And I've gotten the notices already. And the person says, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to write a check right now, and we're going to bring you right up to date. Oh, at first you'd say, are you kidding me? You do that for me? And then they go further and say, here's what else I'm going to do. I'm going to take on your debt. You don't have to worry about it from this point forward. Say, what? Now, what happens in that? They go to the bank, they set that up, and it's paid each time. Do they renegotiate all of that? Mm-mm. Does it somehow become less for the guy assuming the debt for them, for the one that took it out? No, they might save something on the interest, but not on the principal. There's no redefining the amount of the debt on that. It is what it is. So the debt that is ours because of our sin is fixed. And God says that justice says you must have payment in full. Jesus is the one that steps in that way. No renegotiation of the load. It is what it is. Propitiation offered to God. That's not a word we use much. In fact, you can look in the New Testament, and if you have the right Bible, you'll see the word show up about four times as propitiation. Here's one. It shows up in Hebrews. It shows up in 1 John. But the fascinating thing about it is we don't even have an Old Testament counterpart to this. The closest we get in the Old Testament to this picture is somehow wrapped up in this idea for the mercy seat, the Ark of the Covenant, the Holy of Holies. But that doesn't even match the word here. There are other words. Atonement, that's in the Old Testament, that covering over, sure. The redemption, yeah, that's spoken about. Or bought, that price is there. Ongoing payments for a never-ending debt. How about the idea of substitute? Oh, yeah, we had the perfect blemish-free lamb that was sacrificed, and that pictures Jesus and his sinless state. A lot of picture imagery there. How about the sending away of our sin? Yeah, that's pictured in the scapegoat. They had two goats. One was sacrificed. The other one, they put the hands on the head and sent it off into the wilderness. Get the sin out of here. I was picturing all that. Propitiation doesn't show up in the Old Testament. It's only about Jesus. Hang on to that. It's only about Jesus. What is it? What do we mean by propitiation? It is the actual payment. Let me try to describe it with a story. Nate and Sally met at work. They're in their 20s, and they kind of get acquainted with each other a little bit. And Nate wants to date Sally, and she agrees to. They go out on a couple of dates on the front end of things. And at some point, she is introduced to Sally's parents, and it doesn't go well. And the problem is, Nate is a bit of a wild guy. He does crazy stuff. It didn't work well. Parents didn't like it and all that. But maybe that would change over time. They continue on, and at one point, Nate decides, I think, let's go do something fun tonight. And they go to a party. Sally's going along. Not her favorite thing to do at all. But he drinks too much, and he is unable to drive safely, but he chooses to drive. They're heading back home early in the morning hours after a heavy partying. They come around the corner and it didn't make it. There's a bank there, and he rolls right up on that, and it rolls over a few times. And nobody moves when they get out. Rescue vehicles come and extract both of them. Both were unconscious. Nate comes to it in the hospital, getting his bearings, trying to figure out what happened. And then he remembers, where's Sally? Is she all right? And those attending to him said, no. Her neck broke. She's paralyzed. I got to talk to her. Oh, no. That's not possible. Not only because of her care, but she does not want to talk to you at all. Weeks that followed, he got the legal paperwork. Parents initiated that. She was fully embracing that and said, there will be a day in court. You have ruined my daughter's life completely from your stupidity. Why would you do that? He never had a chance to talk with her. And so then the lawyers start talking together. and they're trying to figure out where to go. Now, what do we have so far? We've got Sally, who was offended by the action. We've got Nate, who was the one who committed that action, and then the very action itself that caused her to be just crippled for life. What do I do? The offense that's not easily fixed. The lawyers talk, and they come back with an idea. Let's bring a settlement to this so it avoids the court system. Now, we're talking significant dollars, in the millions. The insurance company settled on that, said this is better than going to court. That money that is brought to that settlement satisfies the demand of the offense by from Sally's perspective. That settlement is called the propitiation. It's the actual dollars that go to her to satisfy the offense that was there. Now, can I just switch the vocabulary now? Our offense to a holy God needed death, a payment we could not pay except by our own eternal separation from God. And Jesus comes in and says, I'm willing to serve. I'll pay the price. I'll be the propitiation. And he does. And that satisfies the righteous demands of the Father. Last week, right here, we sang, Jesus, thank you. Your blood has washed away my sin. Jesus, thank you. The Father's wrath completely satisfied. Jesus, thank you. Once your enemy, now seated at your table. Once your enemy, now seated at the table. Jesus, thank you. I'm trying to get my mind around that. But it adds a level of punch to what Jesus said from the cross. Do you remember that? It is finished. It is paid. Oh, the propitiation. It's paid. The enemy status we have with God is changed because God's satisfied with the payment in exchange for my sinfulness. And now I can be around the table. The table of fellowship. How did that happen? It happened because of Jesus. Justice, redemption, Christ, propitiation.